Now your master's a boy. You that build all of the guns, you that build the dead plane, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, just want you to know that I see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like the Judas of old, you lie, you deceive. World war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. Like I see through the waters that run down my drain. You fasten the triggers for the others to fire and sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion as the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and buried in the mud. Well, that's the worst fear that can never be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Threatening my baby unborn and unnamed. Oh, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. Though I'm younger than you, even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. Well, that's the worst fear that can never be heard.
Now, somehow that didn't turn out to be Silent Running by Peter Shickley, my intro, because you do not fade down, Odetta. You just don't. Not unless you're really... well, somebody I don't want to talk to. But I do want to talk to you because you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. Oh, God. I started out in sort of like a semi-maudlin kind of a state. I didn't even know, was I supposed to be on the air or not? I checked and I checked and I checked. And by all indications, by any memo that I received, well, it was a blank. The last thing I had seen was, you'll be on the air unless you are contacted. I was not contacted. I come in, there's a schedule on the computer here that only I can, that only the people in this room and other people on the local network could see. And I'm not on it, but Catherine Davis and Paulette, being who they are, were very giving. And I'm glad because, yeah, I've got a long... wait, before you go. I'm going to be playing part of a long interview with Frank Herbert. So I was going to lead up to this, but I'm going to just blurt it out. Frank Herbert was somebody who affected so many people in so many ways, including Robert, who was, as anybody knows, an avid, avid, enthusiastic science fiction reader. He got it. We didn't always necessarily agree on favorites. I thought I turned that up. Let's try that again. No, tap the mic. Now try it.
Yes.
Yeah, there it is. So why is that mic 3? That's weird.
I don't know why.
I don't know why. And Robert and I thought that Frank Herbert just had to be like the coolest person in the world. and then the book, before Robert came here, the book Children of Dune came out. And I had the opportunity, because he was on a whirlwind tour, he like did the Today Show, then he came over to WBAI and got me. But at least I dragged in Margot Adler, so it was a great interview. And years later, Robert and I were talking about it, and I broadcast this very thing that you're about to hear. And one of the things that sort of came out of it, and it was really Adler who was able to bring that out, was that Frank Herbert was not necessarily what we would call a progressive individual. I'm not sure that today he might not be a Trumper. That's not fair. That's not fair. I can't talk about a man who died 25 years ago, what he would think today. But he was not progressive.
How so?
It's something that really comes through in the interview. You know, when I talk to writers, I simply converse. I'm a host. I chat. Adler, with all of her journalism background, Columbia University, Berkeley, radical, one of the Vinnie Serrano's Brigade. She had that really let's get into it kind of thing. And she started asking the hard questions, naming names of the politics of the era. And if people stay tuned through three, you'll hear part of this, because I'm going to play the second half of the interview. Not my rambling, but Adler and I together talking to him. And it starts really getting into how, I don't even, you know, it's not a simple us versus them, but it should be clear to anybody that the first novel, Dune, and the miserable novel, Dune Messiah, like Children of Dune, Dune Messiah is awful. I love Dune. Dune is great. 51 years old now. And it was really, could be interpreted as the Harkonnens versus whoever the bad guys, no, the Atreides versus the House of Harkonnen, read Palestinians versus Israel. And not saying which is which. The spice is oil. This is, and he says it almost outright during this interview. And I'm not sure that I don't fall on the same political side as many of my comrades here as BAI, which is as it should be. We shouldn't all think the same. But I also know that I'm not very well informed, so I keep my opinions away from the microphone. But Herbert was not that kind of person. He's a very outspoken man. And I don't think we would care for what he had to say. Hmm. That simply, this was appointed. House Atreides should vanquish, and it does, of course, in the books, the Harkonnens, and are, of course, by the God Emperor and all the stuff that happens, these are the chosen people. I'm a Jew, okay, and I support the concept of the pre-1967 land of Israel for various reasons, and it's not an argument that anybody needs to get into. That's simply who I am. I feel that also as a Jew, we are all disgraced by what happened afterward. But that's neither here nor there. I think Herbert would have a far more absolutist view of what was going on. This is no longer a part of Dune, because the books are now being written by Kevin J. Anderson, who's a very different person and a progressive, and in my opinion, and Brian Herbert, who's there for the name. And so Robert Knight and I actually got into it at one night on the air, where Robert was appalled. Some of the things that I took away from it. And he listened to the interview that you listeners will be hearing. And he didn't turn away from Dune. But he said to me, you defend Wagner. You like Wagner's music, not his politics. Mm-hmm. I said, that's right. He said, well, I'm going to have to think about Dune in a similar manner.
Hmm. Okay.
Now you've read Dune, I assume.
I haven't read Dune.
Ooh.
I haven't. And that's one of the many books that I have to read. But I know how much it was dear to Robert's heart.
Yeah.
That and the film version. You ask him any time of day what his favorite film was, what his favorite book was. It was Dune and The Making of Dune and... You know,
and all that stuff.
All that stuff.
It's, you know, everybody loathes and detests that movie, and Robert and I found common ground in that we both really liked that. My problem with that film is that it runs about 2 hours too short.
Oh.
Because it's this massive, epic story. And today, they, you know, but it's not an eighth of the length of Harry Potter.
Hmm.
So today, were they to remake it, and there is talk, by the way, and I hope they don't, if I remade it once and did a poor job, you know, maybe somebody, and it's already been tried as a miniseries, Children of Dune, actually, on starring Susan Sarandon, of all people.
Okay.
But the original movie by David Lynch, mm-hmm. it went overboard, because there's a lot... One of the things that you haven't read the book.
Not yet.
But one of the things that makes the Baron Harkonnen evil is basically that he is gay. There's a word. That he was lusting after his nephew, who in the movie is played by Sting. And David Lynch could not put that in his film. So he made the Baron a bloodsucker, literally. You know, he had slave kids that he would...
suck. I've seen the film.
Oh, you have seen
it? Yeah.
Okay. The film's actually fairly faithful to the book in many ways, except that there's so much cut out. Mm-hmm. There's just so much missing. A lot of the culture of... I mean, to me, the most interesting thing are the culture of the Freeman. With the blue within blue eyes.
Yes.
It's a fabulous thing that he puts in there. And I would like more of that. And, of course, I would like more of the Bene Gesserit. And not just the evil side that they tend to show and the side of power.
Hmm.
So I found the book to be homophobic. And leaning a little to the right. Which the movie, I think, does not reflect, because David Lynch is very different. And Lynch hated what they did to the film so much, he had his name removed.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Some copies of the film says it's directed by Judas Priest.
Okay.
But if and when you read that book, I would love to have a discussion on the air about it with you.
Certainly. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I'd like to have one in general with you and Catherine, because the last two times I've been on during this thon, I've been talking about people of color in science fiction, which is, finally really coming into its own. And there's a documentary being produced called The Invisible Universe by Oslie Dukan, who was on my show, I guess, 3 weeks ago. And that's coming to fruition. So, and I would love to hear, I'd love to just host a discussion with various WBAI people about that topic. And the first week, Catherine, I had and actually tonight as well, if people want to pledge by dialing 516-620-3602 for a mere $25 to simply become a member of WBAI, I will give you interviews with Samuel R. Delaney with his first radio drama here. He was a staff member here, second person I ever worked for here, with Nalo Hopkinson, with Octavia Butler, with all the great, not all the great black writers of science fiction, because now there's a lot, thank God. And Nora Jemison and Kate Jemison and all that. You met her. Mm-hmm. I would like to have more of a discussion that isn't just me.
Okay, we can make that happen.
Doesn't have to be during a thon. But if people want to pledge $25, I will give you 15 hours or more. Because I'm still calling through my archives and saying, oh, there's a good one. Bang. And $25, 516-620-3602. So I didn't mean to stop you guys from going home.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay, yes, I did. But there was also a thing with Rod. I'm here because when I was taken off the air 5 years ago by the program management of that time, that manager, that program director, did not want to, delete me from the radio. And he looked for another time slot for me, and he got Robert to give me a half an hour of his time. Robert was midnight to two. And then there was some awful show on, a recorded show from two to three. And, I just remembered what it is, and I won't say. So we're actually in, there is a natural, always has been a natural commonality between the listeners of Earthwatch to the listeners of Hour of the Wolf, if not necessarily the host, and I believe that to be true of Heart of Mind. Mm-hmm. And we weren't clock watchers. I might come in early, he would stay late. Transitions are a good thing like that. So that's why I kept you here on purpose.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. More to the point. But I would really, really, I've said this off the air, now I'm saying it on the air, I would really love perhaps next thon to have, like, us.
I think we should do it between thons.
Fine.
It would be better. Then we'll record it and then people can pledge for it.
I'll one-up you on that. I think we should do it downstairs at the Commons with an audience. Record that.
That sounds good.
And use that as a premium.
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
But people have to come to the Commons then.
Yeah. Including this coming Tuesday, because I got an event there on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But as I do the first Tuesday, they were open when I came in here.
Yeah, Katie Halper did something.
She had like 90 people attending. That's darned good. I beat that 2 months ago. I had like 110 people. Last month I had about 30. Next Tuesday, we need a lot of folk. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
For being here.
Thank you for being
from
here.
From midnight and for hanging out with me a little, because...
My pleasure.
Yeah.
We'll do more of this.
And yes. And there was an important thing as well, being that I spent last Saturday at a memorial, Saturday before last, for an old-time WBAI person who was never on the air, so people don't know him. And I found out through a former station manager online that our former program director, Nanette Raynone, recently died, and that was a shock. To me, and then talking about Robert and tying that into Margot Adler, and I am just getting real upset here. So,
well, I think that all of these
therapies.
I think that all of these people who you named, and some of whom were extremely close to me, they leave a legacy, you know, and you know, we all leave footprints, and they have very deep footprints.
Oh, yeah.
And it's important, I think, to remember that.
Yeah, and to see that those footprints don't get just swept away by an ocean wave of new people.
Definitely.
Who don't have an institutional memory.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I thought you were good people to share that with.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for that. So, Paulette and Catherine, we're back to normal programming next week, right?
Allegedly, yes.
Allegedly, yes. Okay. Okay.
So, on that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the best.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, that's all depending on where a person is listening. So I mentioned Nanette Raynone, and I want to read her obit in yesterday's New York Times. Nanette Raynone, who as a reporter and programmer of the radio station WBAI in the late 1960s and early 70s, created some of the programs dedicated to feminism and women's issues, died on May 23rd at her home in Manhattan. She was 73. That you know, she was 73. It's like going, really? 73? And then I remember I'm 63. And I'm like, oh, God. The cause was complications of breast cancer, her son Bruno Blumenfeld said. Ms. Raynone was a volunteer at the station in 1969 when she developed the idea for Womankind, a feminist news and information radio show that included interviews. At the time, feminism was struggling to earn a place in left-wing politics, where radical ideas still coexisted with sexist attitudes. Ms. Raynone hoped to overcome this paradox, taking a point of view shaped by her membership in groups like The Feminists and New York Radical Feminists. She soon added a Lectury Wired, a program produced entirely by women for women. But for the record, by the way, I learned how to edit by taking duplicates of air checks of Lecture Rewired. After Liza Cowan would be done with the show, I'd make a copy of the show, return her air check to her, and that's how I learned how to edit. It was broadcast live at night and ran until dawn, with listeners calling in to discuss the topics addressed by the host, Liza Cowan, and her guests. In late 1970, Ms. Raynone came up with a third program, Consciousness Raising, in which seven regular guests gathered at the WBAI studio in Manhattan once a week to talk about topics such as marriage, divorce, housework, and sexuality. Ms. Raynone edited the show's down to 45 minutes, broadcast it on Fridays at noon, and let listeners call in to express their opinions for another 45 minutes. The idea, she once wrote, was simple: to present a group of women honestly discussing their lives. In 1971, she became the head programmer of WBAI. She was a producer of The Sex Program, that's MME on the end, which encouraged listeners to call in and seek advice from sex therapists, and of a radio series on women's diaries. Okay, and then it goes on and on about her life, which is, you know, worth knowing about, but, you know, get the New York Times. I was shocked to find out, I never knew, she and I went to the same high school, not at the same time. She was 10 years older than I, but she went to Newtown High School in Queens, and then 65 earned a degree in English from Queens College. Well, I taught a continuing adult education course, at Queens College, as did Simon Locley, by the way. And we go back to the professional part of her life. After leaving WBAI in 1976, Ms. Raynone worked on the mayoral campaign of Representative Bella Abzug and became the communications director for Howard Golden, the Brooklyn Borough president. Okay, before people get up in arms, it's Howard Golden, not Marty Golden. While in Mr. Golden's office, she created the Fund for the Borough of Brooklyn, now called BRIC, B-R-I-C, for Brooklyn Information and Culture, to present free performances and cultural programs as a way of attracting visitors to the borough. And one may point out that the current director of BRIC is Anthony Riddle, who's the person who posted about this in the WBAI forum on Facebook, which is how I found out about the death. And I never knew that there was crossover. That's why he attended. I wondered, why didn't I know, when I know all these folk from the 70s? And Tony Riddle came to us in the aughts, I guess, in the either the late 90s or early aughts, turn of the century. As the fund's president, an office she held until 2002, she organized the annual Celebrate Brooklyn Festival in Prospect Park and played a key role in creating the Rotunda Gallery on Clinton Street, which showcases the artwork of Brooklyn residents as well as Brooklyn Community Access Television, now called the Brooklyn Public Network. And that's something else that I believe Tony Riddle runs. In the mid-1970s, when radical politics seemed to be losing some of its fervor and sense of direction, Ms. Raynone reaffirmed her faith in WBAI's mission in its program guide. The station stands, having been the first to present women's programming, as the only media institution which has not virtually abandoned the question raised by the movements since the demonstrators left the streets. So that is from yesterday's New York Times. I'm reading it from their app. Article written by William Grimes, whose byline I know. He's a very good writer. And he is very good. But those words that he said about Nanette, you know, what do you say after that other than she was important? There's a lovely picture of her in the Times, and I posted one of a whole bunch of us at a benefit for WBAI which were the Pooh Players. It was 1972. I remember the exact date because it was, God help us, the day that George Wallace was shot, which is, I guess, you know, just, well, it makes it easy for me to look up and say, when was that? Well, it was the day Wallace was shot. When? Google that up, and, well, hey, now I know the date. That picture is in the WBAI forum and on my page on Facebook. But what do you do after reading about what this woman did for this radio station? And you think about those years. Under her watch, Hour of the Wolf was started with Margot Adler. And Margot became one of our news personnel, reporting to Paul Fisher. And the programming that she did, you know, some people, definitely the golden era of WBAI is probably starting about 66 through 76. And that is her era. That is her reign. A lot of the greatness of WBAI follows the legacy that Nanette left. And, you know, I wasn't prepared for this. I only found out about this a few hours ago. So I read that, and after reading that, I ask you to call area code 718. No. Looking at the wrong sheet of paper. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. And I ask you to do one of two things. For $25, if you pledge $25 to WBAI, you can get the premium I was mentioning, which is many hours of audio of interviews and work of some of the great people of color in science fiction and fantasy and horror. Or, and maybe, I think you can probably do both, and especially if you go to WBAI.org and pledge through there, or you can use the website give, numeral 2, WBAI.org. So it's give to WBAI.org. But you don't write in T-O, you use the numeral. And find under Arts and Music, you'll find Hour of the Wolf. You can donate in the name of that program. You can get that pledge. But also, under comments, write in for Nanette Rainon, N-A-N-E-T-T-E, Rain as in rain, R-A-I-N-O-N-E, Nanette Rainon. And, you know, I was not in touch with her since she left the station in 1976. But, you know, not long goes by without her in my thoughts. And we lost another WBAI, yet another BAI person earlier this year, but he was in Australia, Jay Rothman. And his memorial was last Saturday, and that I actually did attend, and it was very, it was a smaller affair, maybe a dozen people there, and we all told stories about Jay and scattered his ashes. He had been a barker at Coney Island, and that's why it was done there and held there. And so all of this has put me into a slightly maudlin mood. Then what do I come up with for today's program? Because I thought I was not preempted, and hey, as far as any memo I received, I wasn't. What can I tell you? Within this interview that we're going to hear in a few minutes, I am joined by, the best part of it, is Margot Adler, who passed away almost 2 years ago. And Margot was certainly, in terms of WBAI and in many, many facets of my life, she was very close. Well, she was my soulmate. You know, there wasn't anything physical between us. But there was everything else. And then later on, when she got married to John Glideman, who's also a friend of mine, and when she came to know my partner, Barbara, they became pretty close friends. Pardon me, I'm trying to find the place I can put my little thumb drive in. And I have to lean well below the microphone to do it. Aha, there it is. I got you at last. Oops. Kathy, you're not, or if you're listening, Catherine, is this your thumb drive, the pink thingy? I think it is. Call me and tell me what to do with it, or send me an email now and tell me what to do with it. So I can, you're here more often than I, and I'll be here next Tuesday, so we can deal with that. Oh, and why will I be here next Tuesday? Oh, I am so glad that you asked. Where did I put that sheet of paper? Next week, I have two events, not one, but two. One of them I'm producing, the other one I am hosting. Is this it? It is. Tuesday, here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. The New York Review of Science Fiction Reading, the monthly series that we hold. And we're very lucky that we have somebody who's coming into town from London. She's going to be my guest on this program next week, which does not let you off the hook from showing up. And her name is Roz Cavaney. Roz Cavaney is a poet, novelist, critic, and activist who worked in publishing in London. She helped found Feminists Against Censorship and was deputy chair of Liberty, which is in England the National Council for Civil Liberties. Among her books are Reading the Vampire Slayer, yay, fandom, Teen Dreams, the award-nominated fantasy novel Rhapsody of Blood, Rituals, and the Lambda Literary Awards finalist poetry collection, Dialectic of the Flesh. She has received a second Lambda nomination for Tiny Pieces of Skull, a novel of trans street life in the 1970s, which she wrote in the 80s and only managed to sell 28 years later. Our other reader is Robert Levy. Robert is an author of stories and plays whose work has been seen off-Broadway. He is a Brooklyn native, so he doesn't have quite as far to travel, and Harvard graduate, subsequently trained as a forensic psychologist. His first novel, The Glittering World, is a finalist for both the Lambda Literary Award in the science fiction fantasy horror category, as well as the Shirley Jackson Award. Shorter work has appeared in Shadows and Tall Trees, Black Static, and Autumn Clulu, among others. So, obviously, this is for our reading series, Gay Pride Month. It's not the first time we've had two gay writers together, but it's the first time I think we've done it in Gay Pride Month, because I try to avoid pigeonholing anything, anybody. I try to, you know, leave it loose. Any time is a good time to discuss people of color in SF or women or what have you. And so I really don't care that this is what's being celebrated on a given month, because I think that this kind of stuff should always be recognized, celebrated, encouraged, and so forth. But because Roz is coming to town, well, so be it. And the Lambda Awards, or the Lammies, as they are called, are a big deal. They're actually being given out next Monday. Our event is on Tuesday. Thank the powers that Robert and Roz are not in the same category. They are not in competition for the same award, because that could be awkward otherwise, to have the two of them as readers the same night. But they're not. And so next Tuesday, free admission at 388 Atlantic Avenue. We begin 7-ish. I suggest arriving about 6:30. Get yourself some coffee. I was lucky, thanks to Katie Alper. They were open late tonight, and I got me a nice iced Americano. It's very good. Thank you, Gary. Although Nora is going to be our barista next Tuesday. And we will ask you if you can afford to give a donation, but if you cannot, as Catherine says, this is a phrase that she has used that I really like and will therefore start using from here on in, no one will be turned away. Okay? So we hope to see you again. That's next Tuesday, June 7th. Between 6:30 and 7, show up for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Okay, the next night, Wednesday night, I tried to avoid doing things Wednesday nights because then I have to come here and do a radio show. And that will be the case with our guest being Roz Keveny. And you know what I just realized? That other sheet of paper I put down, that was from the one that I read last week. So where is the next one? Well, I'll tell you, okay? Elizabeth Crowens has a new book out called Silent Meridian. And it involves a time traveler from the likes of H.G. Wells meeting up with various other people from that Victorian era, including such folk as Arthur Conan Doyle. No, no, no. In no way, shape, or form resembles that TV series that I've watched that is really bloody yick. This is actually a very fun, very good novel, the first of a series. And there, and Elizabeth will be reading a portion of that novel with one of the characters from that book. And I will be hosting. It basically will be an episode of Hour of the Wolf live. And it's going to take place next Wednesday, the 8th, at the Mysterious Bookshop. And I don't have that information in front of me because I left it somewhere. But look up the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, and that will tell you. But I will be able to, I'll run out and find in which room I left that information. But and by the way, Mysterious Bookshop is a great bookstore. It is so much fun. So come early and get lost in the racks, as it were, and enjoy a reading from Silent Meridian, followed by an interview, and eat some cookies. And I don't know if they're going to be serving whiskey or not. There is a rumor. There is a rumor. Okay. Gotten those out of the way. Well, 40 years ago, almost exactly, when Children of Dune came out, the third book in the Dune series, Frank Herbert, the author, told me that he had set out to write three books to begin with, which, between you and me and the lamppost, is something that I think may not have been fully the case. Dune was to have been a complete work. Dune Messiah seemed to me to be very, very rushed. And as I mentioned earlier when Paulette was here, I don't think it's a great book. Children of Dune brought me back into the fold. And what Children of Dune is it continues the adventure and draws you back to something you really like and love. But Dune itself was a game changer. And the Nebula Awards were just given out 2 weeks ago. And Dune, I believe, was the very first winner of the best novel for Nebula, for the Nebula, which is given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. I'm trying to think now, did it tie with Left Hand of Darkness? It doesn't matter. It's a great book. It was a cult book of the era about the same time that there were two books that were the cult books. One was Lord of the Rings and the other was Dune. I think that's the easiest way to put it. So I am, now we don't have the time to play this whole thing and we're not going to. I am going to make this and many, many, many more interviews available to you during a fundraising drive after June 14th. Why specifically June 4th? Well, it's not because that's the next fund drive. Lord help us. I hope it's not that close. But because I'm going to, well, I'm going to have something on June 14th. If you want to know more, shockingly, you can go to a place that sells audiobooks like Amazon.com or Downpour.com or Audible.com and search on my name, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you'll see why. I will have some full-length, cool interviews available for you to help benefit WBAI. Ah, but why wait? Why wait? Right now, only a mere $25 is all I'm asking for at area code 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602. Take advantage of that premium I've got of People in Color and Science Fiction and do WBAI a favor because institutional memory here isn't as strong as perhaps it ought to be. Look up, put in there, in memory of Nanette Reynon. If you'd really like to do something in memory of Nanette, the regular subscription at that time was $45. $25 if you're a student, retired, or unemployed. Everybody always asks, how do you know? Answer is, well, we'd ask you. And if you say yes, then we'll assume that you're not lying. Quite an assumption, but it always worked. So if you'd really like to make a pledge in the name of Nanette Reynon, pledge $45. How's that for a thought? Okay. So I am just going to play like the first 5 minutes of the interview with Frank Herbert. I need to say that I had lost track of this interview. I have it somewhere, but most of my stuff is on analog tape. Some of it reel-to-reel, some of it cassette. It has gotten lost through the years. I did play the reel-to-reel version of it for the last time that reel was capable of being played on a machine. We don't even have any such machines anymore. But one of my regular listeners is this lovely fellow in Bulgaria who made a whole huge bunch of old air checks, complete air checks of Hour of the Wolf, available to me, and this was among them. So we're going to play about the first 5 minutes of Frank Herbert and I speaking, and then we're going to fade down and skip about, 40 minutes or so, when Margot Adler joins us in the interview. So set your time machine way back for about 41 years. Actually, 10 years, because that's when this rebroadcast first came from. I don't have permission to use the name on the air, but thank one of my, no doubt, many listeners in Bulgaria for making this available from 10 years ago. And here it is.
What else? What books would you
advise? You want a complete list, right?
Yeah. What books would you like people to read?
You're going to science fiction. How about Eyes of Heisenberg?
God, how about my voice change?
Right. Mm-hmm. I read that as Heisenberg's Eyes, I think.
That's okay.
I'm just trying to remember. That
How about Hellstrom's Hive?
Hellstrom's Hive, I've heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Soul Catcher?
Yeah.
How would you classify that?
Soul Catcher? It's a novel.
Okay. Do you disdain the term science fiction?
No, not at all. I don't take part in the argument about mainstream, new wave,
old wave. I don't take a part in any of these arguments. I think they're nonsense arguments. A lot of people argue about mainstream and science fiction. I think what you do is you write the best you're able, no matter which category you choose.
And the difference between them is the difference between jazz and classical.
Max just pointed out, if I had interviewed him before, why was I happy to meet him? So this must have been the first interview.
Use the same notes, the same notation.
Going meta. That was me interrupting
many of the same instruments.
So now I'm going to interrupt.
Which do you prefer?
Then.
What a nonsense question. Sometimes I like classical, sometimes I like jazz. It depends on the mood I'm in at the time.
When you are in one of these moods, do you set out to write a particular kind of novel?
Oh, I always plot very strongly, very heavily, and in depth. I always do deep characterization. I have file folders with each character's name on it and the data in it. I may bring a character on stage at age 30 on page 40 of a novel, but I'll have a file folder wherein I've taken that person's history back to year one and earlier. I know who his parents were, when he was born, what trauma he suffered growing up.
His first sexual experience, everything.
I would like to see the file of Pander Olsen.
Pander Olsen? Well, you know who Pander Olsen is, don't you?
Well, it's an obvious anagram to people who are familiar with science fiction.
Yes, Paul Anderson.
Right.
Well, we play this as a kind of a game, you see. I have another character in there who in one of my books called Holjans von Bruck, who is a very famous science fiction writer. You don't know. John Holbrook Vance, who is not Henry Kuttner, who is...
not Bruce J. Friedman. Were you aware that Bruce J. Friedman wrote some softcore pornography under the name Jack Vance?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, just to confuse matters.
Yeah. Well, Jack is a very real person.
So you're getting there's a lot of fanish talk here, and a lot of it is fun. For some reason, I'm not sure why we're getting all those sound artifacts in there, MP3 artifacts, because you know what? I have another version of the same interview. And it's the complete air check from Hour of the Wolf where I last broadcast that. And, I've already put it away, haven't I? Yes, I have. Well, you know, bear with us a moment. And we're going to put on a cut of music, and I will be back very shortly with the latter part of the interview and hopefully a better quality interview. And, yes, the merry-go-round broke down. You may not know the song by its title, but you sure as heck know it by its tune. This is Pio Wackett.
I'm sitting in studio.
There we go.
Oh, the merry-go-round broke down as we went round and round. Each time 'twould miss, we'd steal a kiss while the merry-go-round went. The merry-go-round broke down and made the dawn the sound. The lights went low, we both said, oh, and the merry-go-round went. Oh, what fun, a wonderful time, finding love for only a dime. The merry-go-round
Your support for WBAI, and may I suggest a $45 pledge in the name of our past program director, for whom there was a memorial, Nanette Raynone. Ah, okay, well, that was the end of the song. What do you know? I didn't realize we had come so close to the end. Okay, here is a different copy of The Source with that Frank Herbert interview. And hopefully the quality here is better. Now let's see, how far are we going in? I was hoping to have more time to work out all these minor details. But it is now in New York City, 2:23. So we have just about time for half an hour. Ah, yes, so this is a very good point, chronologically speaking, and we're just going to fade in to the continuation of the interview with myself, Frank Herbert, and Margot Adler.
A pre-embedded myth, which was all the myth system, which was already in our society. Who called them Camelot? You see, who brought that out? It was a natural thing to happen. They had the young hero, the seeking the Holy Grail, who could do no evil. They had the virgin queen, who marries the young hero. They had the wise old man. They had the fool. I hope Pierre Salinger doesn't mind my calling him the fool. Well, in the tarot sense, you know, that this is not a foolish thing.
Yeah.
The fool in tarot was the one who asked the improbable question.
Yes.
They had the magician, the man who does the impossible, who does the unexpected, Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
They had all of the characters that you find in classical mythology, and they had such perfect fits in their Camelot that you wondered if it just happened or if they did it.
I guess the last card in laying out this in that particular tarot plan would have been the Tower.
In fact, it is the world.
It is the world, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider, and I have a very strong suspicion that you do you consider science fiction, in fact, myth-making, myth-constructing?
A lot of science fiction is myth-making. I've written several books to explore different myth-making lines in our society. I wrote Destination Void, for example, to deal with that element of fandom, which believes that the only thing wrong with the universe is that we haven't invented the right machine yet. The machine becomes their god. It already is.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to examine these assumptions, these unexamined assumptions in our society. Take a good, long, cold look at them.
Mm-hmm.
We have right now upcoming a political campaign in which it is highly likely that Jimmy Carter will be elected president. Carter is setting himself up and being set up because it doesn't happen all from within. The society tends to reflect back on the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Is setting himself up to fit a certain mythological pattern, which is already there in the unconscious of our society. He has set a difficult role for himself, to be both the young hero and the wise old man simultaneously. I think he's capable of it. I just hope that he, personally, does not get lost in his own mythology, because we tend to kill our heroes in this society.
Mm-hmm.
In this Western society. And I think that that's a kind of a of an expelling a foreign body part of it in the society, that the society as a whole turns, gets violent.
Mm-hmm.
I deplore it, but I tell it does happen, and there's a long history of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are probably a limited number of myths that are simply destined to recycle themselves constantly?
Well, I think that that has been the history of myth-making in our society, because if you will find counterparts to Western mythology in Oriental mythology,
mm-hmm.
you find almost perfect fits. what I'm saying is that we ought to explore this myth-making facility in human beings as a consciousness exercise, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Would you correlate the Dune trilogy to any past myth?
Any past myth?
One that is known, say, to classics majors or...
Well, I drew on Greek mythology mm-hmm. for it. The Atreides or the family of Atreus, you know, and a lot of people have spotted this. A lot of classical scholars have spotted it. And I deliberately did this.
I noted... in Children of Dune, that one of the people speaking to Alia from within is Agamemnon.
Yeah. No, and, the family of Atreus, you see.
His family goes back a very long way.
Yes.
It would bring about also an interesting question that since they span so many centuries from the Orestes time through the time when Arrakis became a power, an economic power to deal with, where would the Atreus family be now?
You mean if they existed as a coherent unit?
Yes.
Where would they be?
Mm-hmm.
You mean in our society right now, today, or?
Well, in the 20th century, in the overall society, not 1970 necessarily, but
probably running oil tankers or banking in Switzerland.
Yeah, banking in Switzerland seems to fit.
Yeah. You see, how the power hierarchies are set up is, well, it happens the same way over and over and over and over again. I don't doubt at all, for example, that the Soviet Union, when it began, when the revolution started, that the people were idealists. For the most part, there mm-hmm. were a few coldly cynical types there. I'm sure of that too, but I'm equally sure that most of the people who lent their muscle and their psyches to it were idealists who wanted to improve the lot of mankind. All right, look what's happened. They have created the most overweening, boulder-like, rock-like bureaucracy that the world has ever seen. And the creation of that kind of a bureaucracy, where it cannot be changed easily, is going to destroy them. Obviously, it's going to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been trying to copy their bureaucracy in our society. I think we have caught the ball ahead of it tumbling down and creating an avalanche. But I'm not absolutely sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet bureaucracy is a thing to marvel at, because bureaucracies in general tend to project people who are not imaginative, not creative, who are ultra-conservative. You see?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, people who, even if they have imaginative intellectual capabilities, suppress them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's survival. That is protective coloration in the area where they must live.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
If somebody came to you and said, well, Mr. Herbert, you are an extremely sophisticated science fiction writer with a great visionary future. We have this little planet called Mars. We don't know what to do with it, but we got some people there whose ideas have not yet been molded. And we want to just put a society on it that will be self-functioning. What society would you put there?
Well, number one, I'd worry about some of the absolutist assumptions in what society would you put there. I would hope that any society that we build after we find out how we build societies would not be so fixed to any one line that it couldn't change. Because it's the ability to change and adapt that gives us our survival. And my dream is that we make the species immortal. Mm-hmm. That's why I like our going to Mars. Why not have that dream? Why not want to have grandchildren to the power of N, you see, infinite numbers of grandchildren off in that future who enjoy life and have all of the beauties of life that we have?
I don't know whether you've covered this, Jim, but it says on the back of the book that you have converted 6 acres or something into an ecological demonstration project. Did you talk about that
yet.
Already? I would really like to know about that.
Well, I'm in the process of working out means, not of isolated survival, but of joining with others.
Have you read Ecotopia, by any chance, by Ernst Kallenbach?
I know about the, yes, Ecotopia. I didn't understand you at first. I thought you said Utopia.
No, Ecotopia.
But Kallenbach got me. Yes, I've read it. I don't believe that any one answer is going to serve us. I'm very much against the use of fission power for electricity, but for none of the reasons that I hear being argued about. It's because I think that we're going to need all of our descendants, and they're going to need all of the real estate they can have, and there is no way that we have found yet to protect ourselves from the kamikaze. And I will give you one little example. Hanford on the Columbia River. A kamikaze attack on Hanford, on their storage right now, would make all of the downstream Columbia River real estate on both sides of the Columbia River uninhabitable. And we're just setting up a lot more of those little enclaves of potentially uninhabitable real estate. And the if you want to see how this is sinking into the psyche of various areas of the world, Great Britain, an island nation, and Japan, an island nation, have both drawn back very sharply from fission power. They know that if they go, if they don't go to a breeder reactor system, that they're going to run out of fuel by the year 2000, and the payoff doesn't seem good enough to them, and I agree with them. I've had some people from Hanford argue with me that, well, France isn't drawing back, but then my answer to that is, well, the people who brought us the Maginot Line and the Concorde can't be all wrong.
I gather you would look towards some kind of decentralized.
Yes, I believe in. Well, we have the capability right now of quadrupling at least our electrical power generation through the use of wind power. And I've demonstrated that for perfect satisfaction. I have built a machine that will do it. Doesn't look like any windmill you ever saw, but it works magnificently. I don't believe that methane is an answer for rolling stock, that is, for running railroads and cars, but it's certainly a marvelous source of energy if you're going to run a stationary internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
So is alcohol. So is hydrogen. All of these things we can get from waste products. The whole concept in the American psyche of things you can throw away and forget about has to be stopped right now. There's no more a way where we can throw things, for one thing, and we need the energy that's potential in these things.
Because getting back to Dune and other books, I think one of the reasons, in my own view, that it was so popular with a lot of people who don't ordinarily enter the kind of science fiction reading situation was because of the ecological framework.
I'm sure that had something to do with it. I hope, though, that it's not taken up by people who are looking for someone who's guilty. We're going to make our own mistakes in our society. If I'd been born in my grandfather's time, I would have made my grandfather's mistakes. We have a terrible propensity in our society for finding guilty people and pointing fingers at them. And oftentimes these guilty people whom we accuse are in positions where they can make decisions of enormous consequences. And all we do by pointing fingers at them is alienate them.
I probably would have to agree with a small portion of that. However, I'm not so sure that power doesn't come into it.
If you want to change the society and not just go on a big revolution trip, if you really want to change the society nonviolently, then we all have to participate in the change.
I agree with that, but I'm not so sure that's...
And we have to set it up so that nobody is excluded from participation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand the reason some people can be excluded, and one of them is that we alienate them. Another one is that we have to understand the capitalization process on which our society operates. The capitalization process, which really is the best process we've ever found in the world for making more jobs. In other words, for making things where people will feel that they are justified in their own existence. We've come into some dead ends on it. I agree. We've made mistakes.
Yeah, that's my one fear about Carter, that he'll get us into another war. He'll make some new jobs and get us into another war.
What do you mean, military jobs?
All kinds of jobs, and that he'll find that that's...
Well, I don't think that that's his bag.
I don't either, but systems sometimes are more powerful.
Oh, I agree that systems can direct the decisions you make.
Technological things might possibly create this leverage in job situation as it currently stands.
Well, if we develop fusion power, for example.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was talking about fission, not fusion.
Right.
If we develop fusion power, and we're not at all sure yet that we can, that we have the plasma working techniques which will do this. But if we can do it, that's going to change the whole energy picture dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that what we're dealing with now is a society where crunch decisions are made by people who control enormous blocks of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And who believe that what is good for them will be good for the society. And that's not necessarily true. The oil cartel is not necessarily making decisions which will help the world at large.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the area, the interstellar area in which Dune takes place, you have an essentially capitalistic economic background. People are shipping spices, smuggling, very analogous to what we commercially have here. What would be a good working political frame to go with that capitalistic process?
Well, we have developed all kinds of political frameworks to use in our world. But the thing that you have to understand about the capitalistic process is that it adapts to change,
mm-hmm.
it makes jobs, and it is susceptible, if you don't overmanage it, it is susceptible to variations which are required by the society around it. Where we fall into traps is in overmanagement, over-legalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we do this out of urgent necessity, urgent immediate necessity, but then we never re-examine the conditions, we seldom re-examine the conditions under which we made those management decisions. You see.
Do you think that we might be better off with an imperialistic capitalism?
An imperial capitalism?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, what I was saying we had.
I'm sorry, but I'm...
you mean, do I think we as a society would be?
Yes.
Not necessarily, no. I'm just saying that that's one of the patterns we tend to fall into. We tend to fall into fiefdoms. After all, what's a corporation?
Mm-hmm.
What's a multinational corporation? There are more than 20 multinational corporations in this world. And I'm not talking about American corporations. I'm talking about multinational corporations, which have budgets larger than France. Now, some of the smallest decisions that are made by executives in those corporations are going to have far-reaching consequences all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a certain point at which it's possible that the country's borders may just break down and that those multinational corporations will simply become the powers?
I have written such scenarios.
Can I ask which?
No stories. I've done it for corporate management executives.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. What is their basic reaction? Would it be, I assume...
Well, they're
shocked
at first, and then they start exploring the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Where would those possibilities lead in terms of where people live? It would seem to me that you
Well, if we get into too heavy a crisis situation in our world, where survival depends on corporate favor, corporate goodwill,
mm-hmm.
We could find people living in corporate enclaves where the corporation protected them, fed them, gave them medical treatment, cradle to the grave by the corporation, you mm-hmm. see. But then you're just going to be building a new cyclic collision society where other corporations will fight. There would be battles between the corporations. I can see another scenario where corporations may prevent war because it's bad for business.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that people have not yet learned.
Yeah.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left to go. To continue with that, could people living under different corporations live together in the same geological area?
Why would they have to?
Well, they might.
Right now, you see, you'll find people who were born as American citizens, people who were born as citizens of France, people who were born as citizens of Great Britain, people who were born as citizens of Tunis, whose first loyalty is to a multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
We've found this in testimony in court cases in the United States by American citizens who admit openly that their first loyalty is to the corporation, not to the nation, but to the corporation.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of if you have, say, a non-sectionalized setup. In other words, you might have this...
What do you mean by sectionalized? You mean localized by area and language?
Yes. In other words, what you might end up having with is, would this be conceivable that in New York you're going to have people from 12 different corporations as such living together within the same city, but each pledging allegiance elsewhere? Might that
Don't
not
we already
be,
have that?
Yes, but might that not be, in fact, a deterrent to this war on the grounds of, well, you can't just bomb the city, you're going to...
Well, of course, I suggested one time, quite seriously, that one way, if we really wanted to prevent war, one way to do it would be to negotiate massive exchanges of population for periods of up to 10 or 15 years. Between the Soviet Union and the United States, between the People's Republic of China and the United States, and the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, where you just shift whole cities. And mm-hmm. you go to live in the Soviet Union, learn the language, learn the culture, live by their rules for, say, 10 years. You are, in effect, hostage to the good behavior of your people, of your American citizens. It would be, it's the way we used to do it. Kings used to have princes from neighboring nations living in their own household as hostages to the behavior of the nations on their borders.
Mm. That would really be a fascinating concept. Do you see that since you said these things do work cyclic, that could very well happen?
I could see this happening. I could see be a marvelous adventure for a whole city to say that they will trade with Murmansk and become, say, some city in the United States would become the city of Murmansk for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a massive dislocation and re-education process, you see. But I think it would have salutary effect on the world as a whole. I don't believe, however, in world government.
Mm-hmm.
I think that world government's a very bad show. I think our strength is in our differences, not in the way we are identical. And world government would tend, under present conditions, I'm sure, to be disastrous. It's like the example I like to use is the example of driving an automobile, where there is a 5-minute delay between turning the steering wheel and the front wheels turning. How soon are you going to be in the ditch? The feedback between what is happening to the society and what we now call government is so slow that it's analogous to that picture of a steering wheel with a 5-minute delay.
Mm-hmm. Do you see people trying to steer us toward that world government now?
Oh, I see lots of movements toward world government around us, but I think that they are misguided idealists. Their intentions are right, but we know what the road to hell is paved with, I'm sure.
Yes. I don't think that there are ever any too many political movements that have been paved with bad intentions.
No, I agree. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the saddest things about it, that it was to somebody, was always a good idea. There are no evil people.
I'm doing this to you for your own good. I'm sorry this rack is stretching your bones.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. But if I don't stretch your bones, you know...
You're going to hell.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The Spanish Inquisition all over. In the time remaining, what are there any things that you would simply like to take to task?
Oh, I think we've touched most of them already. I believe that the major argument I would make is against this kind of absolutist dominance of decision-making in our society. This society, for example, created Richard Nixon. I am profoundly sympathetic to him because I'm quite sure that he never woke up any day in his life and said, "Today I'm going to do an evil thing."
Mm-hmm.
He was operating by the rules to which he was conditioned. The society created him. But then the society, needing a scapegoat, turned on him rather than looking to its own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to do that time and again, not looking at the society's shortcomings, but picking ourselves a goat. We chase the goat out into the outer darkness and say, "Ah, that's cured it."
How does one change that society? How does one say, all of a sudden, through some miraculous vision in the sky that says, "Look inward," they look inward and see that it must, something has to be changed.
Well, we have to allow our politicians to make a few mistakes. They're mm-hmm. going to make them anyway, but under present conditions, if they make mistakes, they're going to cover them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't allow them to make mistakes. I think one of the most engaging things that Jimmy Carter, he endeared himself to me by saying, "I blew it," when he was talking about ethnic communities. He said, "I made a mistake." Well, that takes a lot of guts in this society if you want a political career, to stand up and say, "I made a mistake." And maybe we're headed toward a new maturity in that we allowed it.
Mm. Okay, well, all I will say then is thank you very, very much. And it was a pleasure.
My pleasure. I hope to see you again.
Okay.
The outro there is premature. And, well, you got to hear, alas, only about a third of the interview with Frank Herbert, and we will make the whole thing available again. In fact, I may just upload the entire thing as is. It's an hour and 18 and a half minutes, and I may just put it up on SoundCloud and put a link to that in the Hour of the Wolf forum on Facebook, and you can just listen to the whole thing there. And yes, that, by the way, was the better copy. The first one, as you heard, really had some issues. And I got rid of it. But the same person who made that available to me gave me information. Dune won for novella. because that is how it was, the Nebula Awards, that's how it was originally published. And, oh, was it that it tied with This Immortal by Zelazny? Don't resend it. I only have 3 minutes left. If you would like to call and comment on science fiction fantasy or what you've been, or Nanette Raynone, or what you've been hearing on WVAI since I came on at 1:30, I'll take calls on the air. We have like 3 minutes. And the area code is 718. The phone number is 780-8888. And that doesn't leave you off the hook to pledge at 516-620-3602. And in the name of former program director Nanette Raynone, who died a couple of weeks ago and had her memorial yesterday, which I only found out about on Facebook through a former BAI station manager, Tony Riddle. And I didn't know why Tony knew Nanette. They were at BAI. They were like, you know, 25, 30 years apart. And then turned out that she's one of the people, after she left BAI in 78, she helped form what is now BRIC, the Brooklyn Institute for Arts and Stuff, and also their public TV station. And she's one of the founders of that. So, wow, that was something. But I was it's so disappointing that I'm just looking through things online and checking the BAI forum on Facebook, where I'm a moderator, and bang, there's a picture and a New York Times, not a picture, there was a note from Tony Riddle saying, I just got back from Nanette Raynone's memorial. And that's a crappy way for you to hear about an important person's death, and one whose work, program director of BAI from 71 through 78, you know, that's what they call the golden years, gang. That's what created a show called Hour of the Wolf with Margot Adler and turned us into a 24-hour station. She created women's programming here. Just so much that Nanette did. And at that time, Bob's in both awards for novel, not novella. Thank you. Note from Bulgaria. Really. Texting can be useful. And she was the program director from 1971 through 78. Here's a photograph of her. And that's from yesterday's New York Times. And pretty much created feminist radio on BAI, which therefore would be to say in the country, with the show Lecture Rewired with Liza Cowan, who I'm in touch with over on Facebook occasionally.
Yesterday's New York Times?
Yeah, the June 1st New York Times.
I think I have it right here.
Oh.
I didn't know.
If you have it, I would let's see, probably be in like the New York section or the metropolitan section or something like that. And whoops. Well, no, that's the front page. But that's the Science Times, so it wouldn't be in either of those. Ah, the Arts. The Arts is a good bet.
All right. Let's see who wins first.
And if it's not in the Arts, it might be. Is there still a Metropolitan section? Let's see. Well, we'll feature that photograph I just showed you. That. Oh. Oh! No, that's Mary Tyler Moore. But those are the obits, indeed. But no. No, well, why is there a picture of Mary Tyler Moore? She didn't die. Did somebody else die? Oh, Michael Dann, who saw. Okay, so he was a producer, an important producer. Okay, well, it's somebody
online
calling in. guess not. At any rate, if you would like to pledge in the name of Nanette Raynon, in those days, it was $45 to become a subscriber to BAI. Why don't you go retro and pledge $45? Because that's what it cost at that time. $25 if you're student, retired, unemployed. That's what we always said. How do we know which one you were? You told us.
Financially challenged.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's really what it was, yeah. Is that we, but we didn't say financially challenged at the time. We simply said it's $45 or $25 if you're a student, retired, or unemployed. But, you know, we didn't ask. Just, you know, you told us which subscription you wanted, and you got it. And that is as it should be. So give us a call now at 516-620-3602. This has been Hour of the Week. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in just a few minutes. And come here, 388 Atlantic Avenue, this coming Tuesday, for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings with Roz Cavaney and Robert Levy. And on Wednesday, June 8th, Elizabeth Crowens will be doing the book launch for Silent Meridian at 58 Warren Street, the Mysterious Bookshop. I will be hosting and recording it for Hour of the Wolf. And a special surprise appearance by one of the people discussed in the book. I hope that to see you at both places. What can we say beyond that? Everybody, be good to yourselves. Be good to others. We all deserve it. And so do you. Have a wonderful week. Have a wonderful morning. Have a wonderful hour. Have a wonderful week. Just, you know, be good. Life is too short for anything else. Good morning.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech. an expression, expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works, jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. A nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fat. And watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
sing.
And you're in tune to Radio Station WBAI 99.5 FM. Every damn time I come to school, up somebody fucks up the entire world. But hey, you know, we got Jim Frost.
But there's so much things that you and I can do to help this situation. Instead of talking heavy on the blues and the stirring of the nation. Fighting. But if only we could find a way to say the right things all of the time, then you and I could see it through the blue, this hard and perilous time. I'm saying that if all of us unite, we could live a happy life. No more suffering will there, if only our love don't fail. Fussing and you're fighting. Won't get you nowhere, so don't bother with it. Don't bother with you fussing and you're fighting. Don't bother with you fussing and you're fighting.